This is Rain Perry, and you're listening to Cinderblock Bookshelves, a guide for children of fame-obsessed bohemian nomads, a collaboration between myself and KWMR Point Reyes Station. Chapter 1.
Well, I was walking down the street, and who should I meet but the boy that was my joy several years back.
I wrote that song when I was 13. I rocked so hard. My name is Rain Noel Perry, and this is my magnum opus. I mean, I thought it was, because when I wrote it, I could not imagine I would ever have this much to say about anything again. This story will feature a colorful cast of characters, wealthy 50s industrialists, Jesus freak hippies, and traveling folk singers. Billy Jack will make a brief appearance, as will Nancy Sinatra and Werner Erhard. There will be sex, drugs, and, yes, rock and roll. And at the center of everything, just where he preferred to be, will be my dad, John Hazen Perry. Since all life stories begin with our parents, it makes sense that I start with mine. In the case of my father, I have to, because my shed, until the Thomas fire, was packed with his files. My dad always planned to create his magnum opus, an epic autobiographical film, preferably starring John Cusack or Edward Burns, an American coming-of-age story told through the eyes of the sensitive young son of a prominent Midwest executive. The loss of 50s innocence. The unsettling freedom of the 60s. The blur of the psychedelic 70s. He made extensive notes and took numerous inconclusive meetings. And when he died of cancer at age 53, those notes came from his long unpaid self-storage unit to me. Opening the boxes had the effect of bestowing on me his compulsion to tell a really big story. However, since I'm the daughter of that sensitive/psychedelic son, mine will be a little different from the story he'd have written. I'm probably going to tell you things he wouldn't necessarily want the world to know. I hope he understands. My 20-year-old father blew west from the green lawns and industrial affluence of Indian Hill, Ohio, leaving behind four sisters, his father, and a brand new stepfamily. Speeding in his triumph past cornfields, over the Rockies, and across the desert at 100 miles an hour, he arrived in L.A. in the fall of 64. Once there, he just kept driving. Down Wilshire, past the La Brea Tar Pits and the Ambassador Hotel, cruising Sunset Boulevard and up winding canyon roads to Mulholland Drive, he raced up Highway 1 and stopped for lunch at Neptune's Neck. He felt what so many have felt in California, freedom and uncertainty, wanting to reinvent himself, but unsure precisely how. Still, an incomplete high school education, an unfinished commitment to the Army Reserve, and his beloved mother's recent death all melted away under the balmy California sun. Enrolled as an actor at the Pasadena Playhouse, he set forth to embrace life anew with a generous stipend from his father. Pasadena was everything the Rose Queen promised as she waved from Midwest TV sets each New Year's Day. One warm evening, walking near the playhouse, my dad looked up to see a lovely young woman leaning precariously out a second-story window, shouting drunkenly down to friends. Miss, he called up to her. Maybe you shouldn't lean out that far. Fuck off, she yelled back. And that refreshingly blunt response, and the wry smile that likely followed, set in motion John Perry's aching love for fellow student Melody Ann Heron. John and Melody were kindred spirits, learning to use the theater to express parts of themselves they couldn't show their families. Falling passionately in love, they spent their time at Melody's lime green and black painted apartment, which led to pregnancy. The lime green and black phase came to a sudden end, and the soon-to-be grandparents swooped in. Despite this unexpected turn of events, and after an appearance on The Newlywed Game, in which they didn't match a single question and answer, John and Melody rose to the occasion and embraced a utopian, bohemian vision of family. My dad's father, John Sr., known to his family as Nonny, sent this letter to his four daughters and one artsy son from Indian Hill. Dear aunts, the above salutation stems from the fact that last night Melody gave birth to a 5-pound, 11-ounce girl. Mother and child doing well, father in a highly emotional state. And this additional thought. P.S. to Johnny. I am happy about the baby, except the name. Couldn't we find something a little less far out? I would prefer Lorraine to Rain, and middle names usually have some family connection. Obviously, it is your choice, but I cannot help but express my opinion. In 1968, Nonny died, and my dad used his inheritance to make his directorial debut, a short film called Dandelion, starring my mom, with musical score by a then little-known Paul Williams. He bought a lot of far-out stereo equipment on which to play an amazing collection of far-out rock and roll records. My first food memory is of artichokes and lobster with drawn butter. In 2 years, the money was gone. In 4 years, the marriage collapsed. Forced to support himself, my dad got a job working for Tom Laughlin, a.k.a. Billy Jack. His duties included house-sitting, some camera work, and driving Tom in his limo. Years later, we would attend a party called Happiness is Being an Ex-Billy Jacker. Truly broke now, Dad moved into a friend's studio and then drifted up to Berkeley. My mom, Melody, and I, the unfortunately named Rain, moved to a Hollywood duplex. My mom pursued what was her true calling, a career in songwriting, even having a record cut by Nancy Sinatra called Kind of a Woman. It went like, well, I'm a wine drinking fast, thinking I winking kind of a woman. Ugh, it's just so cool. But single motherhood began to overwhelm, and my mom joined a Redondo Beach Christian fundamentalist hippie church. Services 6 times a week. A lot of witnessing.
The alternative that'll destroy you. And just come and get saved. You know, you can, right now, tonight, just believe it and it'll happen.
I sent this letter to my father. To Dad, Jesus is the Lord. Please get saved. I love you, but Jesus loves you more. One Wednesday afternoon in 1974, my mom got sick. And no one knew what toxic shock syndrome was in the early 70s. So no one understood how an apparently healthy 27-year-old woman could pass away overnight. Struggling to pull himself together, my dad came down from Berkeley the following Monday, took me from the church, and packed up my stuff, then brought me to my Brownie to Girl Scout promotion ceremony, where I crossed over a small wooden bridge. And so it was that I came to be raised in various locations by my single dad, John, eventually settling in Ojai, California, where I made a life for myself and started a family. My dad died in 1999. I successfully grieved his death, planted a tree in his name, and lived happily ever after. Okay, there is more to the story. The truth is that everything is going great. It's just that I keep yelling at my family.
Something's got to give.
First there is something's got to give.
So, my dad found unexpected purpose in trying to raise me in a new and improved way. He appealed to wealthy family friends for rent money for a shared house in Mill Valley, supplementing his income with pot plants he grew along the stairway, a source of some concern to my maternal grandfather Bob when he appeared for a surprise visit, which later prompted this letter from my dad. Dear Bob, despite the intense and occasionally heated nature of our conversation yesterday, I am glad I called. I must admit that with the plants out of the house, I feel a bit more relaxed. Every night at bedtime, no matter what else was going on, my dad spent 15 minutes or so encouraging me to grieve or share with him whatever was on my mind. I could tell him anything, and I did. He collaborated with a couple of friends on an autobiographical screenplay, and a corkboard of 3x5 cards decorated our living room wall. Despite the roommates, the house in Mill Valley became too expensive, so Dad sold his stereo and most of his albums and moved us north to be closer to some of his childhood friends in coastal West Marin. He found a cheaper place on narrow, tree-lined Balmoral Drive, in the little town of Inverness, where hippies lived communally and cheaply in big old houses. Blackberries and forget-me-nots grew wild, and banana slugs lurked below moss-covered trees. I close my eyes and see myself in the dust of summer on my purple one-speed with a banana seat, screaming down Inverness Way with my friends, ditching our bikes in a heap, and crowding inside the Inverness store to buy wacky packs and gobstoppers. I see kerosene-lit jam sessions at the Fall House, the Greenhouse, theater games, and big meals of brown rice, tofu, and veggies. I hear the music everyone was listening to, and we kids were taken seriously, even though we were kids. My dad's girlfriend was 6 or 7 years younger, and the three of us were always setting off on some exciting adventure. She was fun, and my dad was fun with her. Around this time, I first put my fingers around the neck of a guitar, my dad's, which I started playing so much that finally he just gave it to me. In the back of the Point Reyes bookstore was the free box, from whence came all the clothes my grandparents didn't buy me. It was always a kick at school to guess who was going to say, "Hey, that used to be my shirt." I recall the heartache of attempting to trade a rennetless jack cheese sandwich on sprouted wheat for bologna and Velveeta. Down the street was the Dance Palace, where my dad acted in and directed plays. The first play I saw there was The Hot L Baltimore. Our friend Lisa played a hooker, and her grand entrance had her running down the stairs after a John who didn't pay, and then whipping off her towel and saying, "I'll be goddamned," naked. Everyone was naked, often. By fifth grade, I was an enthusiastic member of the Junior Palace Players. Inverness in the 70s was the kind of place where a tenuous duo like my dad and me could not only survive, but feel right at home.
I said goodbye from the hospital doorway. Now I'm standing one last time in my mother's room. This is the beginning of experience. Innocence is gone too soon. I climb in the car with my father. Why my say goodbye to the South Bay. We drive all night for West Marin. He puts his hand on my shoulder. He doesn't know lumberyard that hold a cup of pens, a hawk feather, a little leather stash box, the works of Sam Shepard, the tale of Siddhartha.
One bright morning in 1978, Mrs. Floyd and Mrs. Myers flung open the accordion wall between their classrooms in the Maud building of West Marin School, bright eyes fixed on the assembled 6th through 8th grade students clustered on the floor. I sat next to my more sophisticated 8th grade friend, Leah. Mrs. Floyd and Mrs. Myers leaned against a desk, adjusted their slacks. "Today," said Mrs. Floyd, "is Sexuality Day," continued Mrs. Myers. "We're here to address your thoughts, concerns, and questions regarding sex." Murmurs filled the room. "Now remember," chirped Mrs. Floyd, "anonymity promotes honesty, so we'd like you to take out a piece of paper and write down any questions you might have." "Go ahead, write anything that's on your mind." I asked something scholarly about menstruation. The questions were folded and placed in a hat. Mrs. Myers drew a paper from the hat, cleared her throat, and read, "Can you get pregnant by butt-fucking?" Stunned silence, punctuated by stoner laughter from somewhere in the back. Leah rolled her eyes. "I know, how stupid," I thought. "Of course you can't get pregnant by rubbing your butts together." Regaining her somewhat slipped composure, Mrs. Myers went on. "I prefer the term anal intercourse, and the answer is no. Mrs. Floyd?" Mrs. Floyd drew another question. It was a three-parter. "Do you screw? Do you like to screw? Have you screwed?" More stoner laughter. "Again, the more appropriate term is sexual intercourse. Do I have sexual intercourse? Well, many of you know my daughter, Kristen, so the answer to that is obvious. And yes, I'm not ashamed to admit that I enjoy relations with Mr. Floyd. I guess I've already answered the final question. Mrs. Myers?" I don't recall how many more questions these two brave teachers answered that day, but I remain grateful to whichever school board members felt it important to filter the sexual revolution into the middle school. I was forced to seek out my drug education extracurricularly. In with my dad at age 7, I watched him clean seeds and stems from his pot. This was the same to hippie kids as seeing your dad clean out leaves and twigs from the rain gutter. In the 70s, pot was a fact of life. You might give a kid a little hit, like you'd give him a tiny taste of wine, but pot was really for when you were older. Until I was 11, my personal experience had consisted of seeing my dad get high and inhaling the secondhand smoke of my stoner friends. I tried it to fit in, and I had acted stoned afterward, But at 11, I was an uncommitted and inept pot smoker. My friend Leah was older, 13, and cultivated a Dorothy Parker-like world weariness. She'd already endured her parents' divorce and her mother's unpredictable temper. She'd been brought to Inverness to live a conventional life with her travel agent father and homemaker stepmother. She was small, round-faced, and porcelain-skinned, despised cheerleaders and anything related to school. She had an impressive vocabulary, loved gruesome crime novels and the work of Edward Gorey. She had a look she'd give when someone was being insufferably stupid. It's kind of an exasperated, exhausted sigh with a rolling of the eyes. I've been on the receiving end of it more than once. But she liked me. I was her stringy-haired comic relief. Her life looked normal, especially compared to mine. She lived with her father and stepmother in a normal house with normal after-school snacks and was compelled to perform normal chores, like emptying the trash compactor. She did not carry smelly canisters of compost out to the backyard. There was no giant bag of organic carrots on the bottom shelf of her fridge, and no roommate named Bear or Superman down the hall with whom to negotiate the bathroom in the morning. There was no sign above her toilet that said, "If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down." One afternoon at her house, Leah produced evidence that her leave-it-to-beaver-looking life was not all it seemed. From a care package sent from Berkeley by her birth mother, she unwrapped a foil packet containing a fat, glistening tie stick. "It's time to get you stoned for real," she announced. "Okay," I replied. She rolled a perfect joint, not because she was a chronic pot smoker, but because of her inability to tolerate mediocrity. Grabbing the tube of fireplace matches, she led me outside her house and into the woods. "Smoke this," she ordered. She lit the joint and I took a hit, or tried. Leah gave me the look of exasperation, dramatically wiped the saliva onto her jeans, and inhaled as well. "Take another hit," she ordered. I did. When she decided I'd had enough, she pinched the end of the joint and wrapped it carefully in a baggie. We walked back to the house and climbed the ladder to her loft. Whoa. The room started spinning around me. Suddenly, I didn't dare close my eyes for fear of getting dizzy. My chest felt heavy. I had to push it out in order to inhale, and my mouth was unbelievably dry. "You are so wasted," she said. I leaned back on the bed. The room was warm, and the wooden walls glowed in the light of her lamp. "Oh, fuck!" she shouted all of a sudden. "What? My dad's home!" This was not something I'd considered. Leah was already up and dragging me down the ladder to the bathroom. "Brush your teeth," she ordered. I did. "Here, use this!" She squirted Visine into my eyes, poured a glass of milk down my throat, and then shoved an orange slice into my mouth. "Stay here," she whispered, closing the door to the bathroom. That was fine with me. "Rain's here," I heard her muffled voice explain. "We went swimming at the pool at the hotel," she cleverly added, laying the foundation for their discovery of our reddened eyes. "Now act normal," she whispered at me. "You have to act normal." "Yes." Leah helped her father and stepmother put away the groceries. How can she maintain? I thought. I can't even think. Leah's stepmother, who apparently hadn't noticed anything amiss, asked me if I'd like to stay for dinner. "Yes." "More mashed potatoes?" "Yes." Later, Leah's dad drove me home. When I came in the door, I told my dad everything about my afternoon. "God, Dad, I am so stoned," I announced. Like any father, he debated how to handle the situation. After a minute or two, he spoke. "Rain, if you're going to smoke pot," he said, "I'd prefer you did it with me."
The best of times are magic. bug breaks down. We leave it in a parking lot and race a shopping cart to town. Have to wait till daylight to hitch a ride home with a friend. So we sing Beatles songs together till the night comes to an end.
You've been listening to Cinderblock Bookshelves, a guide for children of fame-obsessed Bohemian romance, a collaboration between Rain Perry, that's me, and KWMR Point Reyes Station. Thank you, Amanda Eichstadt, and everyone at the station. Recording, sound editing, and music by Ken Arrows. The album Cinderblock Bookshelves was produced by Mark Hallman at the Congress House in Austin, Texas, and is available wherever you find your music. Cinderblock Bookshelves, the play, was written by Rain Perry and performed by Rain Perry and Danny B. Hardy. It had its world premiere at Theater 150 in Ojai, California on February 8, 2008. It was directed by Kim Maxwell and produced by Sasha Heslip. With set design by Robert Pryor, sound design by Dirk Schubert of Schubert Systems Group, and visual effects by Owen Renfro. Music concepts for the play were developed with the assistance of Danny B. Harvey and Jonathan Raffetto. Thank you for listening.